session number 19013, reel 1.
This is an interview with Mr. Bob Rose, a World War II glider pilot, recorded by Rodney Giesler for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive on the 23rd of July 2002.
Oh, yeah. When and where were you born, Bob?
I was born in St. Helens in Lancashire. It's about 12 miles from Liverpool. And that was on the 12th of May, 1921.
Uh-huh.
So I'm 81.
81 now, yes.
Yeah.
And did you live most of your life pre-war out there?
Yes, I worked for Pilkington as a glass manufacturer. My father was a manager with them. And I left school at 14 and went into the office. And then, of course, when you became 16, you're in for an apprenticeship. Always wanted to be an electrician, but the only job that coincided with mine was a joiner. So I went into the joinery business and learnt my trade there with Pilkington's. My father was an ex-Royal Engineer, TA, he was Staff Sergeant. Got the DCM during the First World War. And it was all my ambition to join that TA regiment in St. Helens. So my 18th, or as near as damn it, my 18th birthday I did, which of course was 1939, the May of 1939.
What was the TA unit?
Royal Engineers.
Royal Engineers.
I had an elder brother who was an electrical engineer, and he went into the Searchlights Battalion, TA in the town. Eventually went over to Remy when that was formed. But I stuck with the Royal Engineers. Of course, we were called up about a fortnight before declaration of war, which was, 3rd of September. And immediately, my company, 252 Company, was sent with the FPO to France. Because I was too young, you normally had to be 19. So I was transferred to a unit in Liverpool, 510 Company that was. And we did various jobs. We got to down into Leicestershire, around Loughborough, Leicestershire, Gadsby Hall, we were stationed there. And we were making hutted camps for people to live in, and bunk beds and this sort of thing, and ablutions.
This is what I mean. What, Nissen huts or were they wooden huts?
They were Nissen huts in the main, but one or two specialist huts had to be made for various offices and things like this. But it was mainly, strangely, bunk beds and ablutions, you know, just knocking these things up. I remember I was about the only bloke who could sharpen a saw. So I found myself as a saw sharpener and setter, keeping everybody else going. It was a nice little job. And then, of course, Dunkirk, and we were moved up to the East Coast. And I was at West Hartlepool, just outside of West Hartlepool, Seaton Carew. And, of course, there we were doing coastal defences, pillboxes, minefields and so on.
You were actually laying the mines, were you?
Yes. I didn't really get involved with that. I was more, you know, using the tools sort of thing. I remember one of the jobs we were doing was to make up, go around and confiscate telegraph poles and cartwheels and this sort of thing, and make dummy guns and stick them along the coast and nail bits of brass and tin on them so that they would glint and camouflage them. So that was the more interesting. And of course, in those days, we used to stand to an hour before sunrise till an hour after, and an hour before sunrise, sunset, and an hour after, as well as the working day, you see, where we were, as I say, filling sandbags or doing concrete.
Were there any troops up there who actually manned the pillboxes?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. There was the Durham Light Infantry, I think, were employed on that job along as we did them. I think one of the more interesting pillboxes we made was we used a carousel. We used to call it a roundabout, didn't we?
Yeah.
And used that to camouflage the pillbox, you see. Dismantled it, built the gun emplacement, and then rebuilt the carousel around it.
So it looked like a fairground.
It was one of our better jobs.
What other camouflage things did you have on them?
Well, they were mainly along the coast. They were sort of beach hut type things and that, or we'd hide them between beach huts and so on. So it, you know, it was a question of initiative all the time, you know, which I suppose the Royal Engineers always prided themselves in. From there, of course, Northern Ireland, and when the aftermath of Dunkirk had sort of died down a little bit, and of course there again we were living on the canvas, I always remember, and building hutted camps for everybody else.
That was well back from the front line, wasn't it?
Oh yes, a long way. Yeah, Northern Ireland. It was a strange place to be, you know. I always remember we used to go into the cinema, and when they played God Save the King at the end, all the locals would be stamping their feet and all the rest of it, and you wondered what you were in for. But
was that Republicans, you know, being against
That's right. Yeah. Well, yes, there was a general feeling, wasn't there? And of course, I hadn't, up to that time, got involved in the Wise and Wherefores. And I had been a choir boy, brought up as a Protestant, I suppose, and didn't understand really the other side. But met quite a few families that got on very well with and so on. In fact, there was a nurse who nursed my mother, and she came from Dungannon down bottom end of Loch Ness, and I used to visit her home and that sort of thing, so it was quite pleasant.
Yeah.
But
whereabouts is your base?
At that time, a place called Dundrum, which let me see, Dundrum, it's a little seaport about midway between Belfast and the southern border. And I always remember it was a seaport, a 400 ton ship used to come in every week, loaded with coal and go away loaded with potatoes, you know. The people who unloaded it and loaded it, they would work like mad for about 3 days to get her unloaded and loaded, and then go to the pub and drink until she came in again. A funny way of life, but there it is.
Did you come across much hostility apart from?
Not really. No, not at all. Really, we used to go to the dances, and I suppose when we got into Belfast, we used to go dancing there and that sort of thing. There was no real hostility. It was just that that's the only thing I noticed. Was this business of when they played God Save the King at the end of the programme in the cinema, they would stamp their feet. They didn't like that. We could have done without it. In fact, I think they stopped doing it. They stopped playing it. They won. But there it is.
What was your next move?
Right, well, thoroughly browned off by this time. Not involved with the war or anything like that. I'd always been interested in flying. My hero when I was about 14, 15, 16 was a Frenchman called Henri Mignet, who built, designed and built himself his own aircraft, which he called the Flying Flea. And that took everybody's imagination about that time. He was an aircraft which you could build in a garage sort of thing, and this was my intention, although I only just started as a joiner. And
what was his name again?
Migne, M-I-G-N-E-T. Yeah, Migne. Yeah. I have a book called The Flying Flea, which was written by him and published by the Air League of Empire Air League, I think it was called, something like that. Publisher was actually down in Somerset. I lost the book after the war. I think my mother had a clear up or something, but I did eventually find a copy in Salisbury, and I've got that copy, which I treasure. But this chap fired my imagination about flying. Bear in mind, of course, I'd left school at 14 with no qualifications. So the chances of, you know, getting onto aircrew duties, I felt, was very, very remote. But suddenly one day on the notice board was this question of transfers to the RAF. Because of the Battle of Britain and shortage of pilots and all the rest of it, they were considering army personnel to transfer to the RAF. Now, I must say at this stage, I thought that this was a bit of a con. I don't know whether you've heard this before or not, you see. I went up to Belfast and the aircrew selection board. And I always remember there were two RAF officers and one other, obviously officer type, if I can put it that way, in civilian clothes. Now, I was quite convinced that he was army personnel, you see. And of course, we were interviewed. We did the usual aptitude tests and all the rest of it, and getting across ravines with three short planks and all that type of thing, which we did. And eventually, I had to sit in front of these three and be interviewed. And the first question that came up was, where were you educated? So I said, St. Luke's. So I left it at that, you see. Now, I, completely naive at the time, I had no idea what the connection was. But this chap said, oh, what do you think of Exeter? And I said, well, I'd been to Exeter some time before. We'd picked some stores up from there, and I said, oh, very nice city and all this, that and the other, you see, carried on. Then he started to talk about my prowess on the rugby field and how fast could I run 100 metres in, and I didn't know, but I came up with a figure which seemed to satisfy him. And when I got back, I started to ponder about this St. Luke's business, you see. I was talking to somebody a little bit more knowledgeable than myself, and he said, oh, well, it's Exeter, it's St. Luke's College. And, of course, what he didn't know, I had attended St. Luke's Church of England School in Knowsley Road, St. Helens. Anyway, I don't know whether that did me any good or not, but they were very quick to tell me that my mathematics were not good enough for me to be a navigator, but probably if we could get someone to fly you here, there, and tell you which way to go, you might be all right, or you could be an air gunner or wireless operator and all this sort of thing. So we came away having had an interesting weekend. And I always remember it was about 3 weeks later, and there were seven of us, and we had individual letters, I suppose, from the War Office, telling us that transfers to the RAF had been cancelled, but in view of the fact that we'd passed the aircrew selection board, we could be considered for the newly formed Diada Pilot Regiment. And of course my first impression was, what, no engines? And not for me. But of course the boredom of the situation in Northern Ireland was such that I think six of us out of the seven decided we would transfer. So I finished up at Till's Head 1 October.
When would this be? About 1941?
42.
42?
Yeah.
Well, you spent quite a long time in Northern Ireland.
Oh, yes, did, really.
Yeah.
Mm. Too long, really.
Yeah.
Long enough to be... in fact, the Americans had just come in. And one of the bitches we had was that they'd moved in and took over a camp which we'd just completed and which we thought we were going to use ourselves. Mm. So that didn't help. With the, you know, the relationship. Anyway, we got down to Till's Head. We were on the canvas.
It was on Salisbury Plain.
Salisbury Plain. Yeah. It's just near West Down Camp, which is the artillery, right upon the top. We spent a miserable winter there, being knocked into shape, as they say, because we had a... Well, the Colonel, George Chatterton, of course, decided that this regiment would be the cream, a la cream, and all this, that, and the other. And he sought the services of the youngest RSM in the Grenadier Guards, and two others, one with the Welsh Guards, one with the Scots Guards, to knock us into shape, as it were. So we spent... you've got to bear in mind that being a Royal Engineer, I was fairly smart, but not averse to put my hands in my pockets and all this sort of thing. hat on the back of my head and so on. And of course, didn't go down well. And the sad part about all that was we had all these people coming in, applying for the regiment, and probably 6 out of 10 of them were going back as unsuitable because they didn't fit into this regime, which had nothing to do with flying at all. This is what...
it was much more discipline than your...
Oh, dreadful.
Yeah.
Dreadful, you know.
Square
bashing, trumped up charges, you know. You always examined the man on either side of you when you went on parade, because... if he had blood on his face, then of course he was on a charge for idle while shaving and was whipped off to the guard room by the people on either side of him. And the chances are, by the time you got to the guard room, you were in the guard room because you were idle whilst on escort duty. And all these horrific stories that we'd heard about the guards and all of that. Anyway, there was some serenity started to creep into it, and I went off to flying school about the following August, I think, having done battle school. And we used to train virtually with everybody in the Royal Artillery, go to infantry battle school and this sort of thing, after this total soldier sort of image, you know.
So for the first time you were soldiering?
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah. Well,
are we still in 42? Or?
Oh yeah, 40, yeah, 42. Coming up now, 43, when I went to flying school. Went to flying school at RAF Booker
in Buckinghamshire.
Yes, near Beaconsfield that way. And of course, for the first time, was able to fly. You know, realise my ambition. I took a long time to solo, they said, about 10 hours. And then after the course, I was posted back to the depot, which had now moved from the old camp at West Down, at Till's Head, to Fargo. You've probably heard them talk Fargo Camp. That was a specially built camp for us, you know, a new camp.
Where was that near?
Lark Hill. Uh-huh. Just at the bottom of the hill from Lark Hill.
What did you do your flying training on?
Tiger Moths.
Tiger Moths.
And about 15, 20 hours on Miles Manchester's. The idea of the Miles Manchester was it was an aircraft which had flaps, which the Tiger Moth didn't, and of course the success, subsequent success of the glider was the use of flaps in order to control your approach and position and so on. So we changed over to those. And eventually I was posted to Stony Cross, which is down in Hampshire, must be Hampshire, near Ringwood. And of course, I think my first flight in a horse, a second pilot, with a chap named Lockwood, the staff sergeant. And we took off from there and went up to doing a circular route. And we finished up not very far from Newbury and ran into low cloud. And of course, this is, you know, one of the worst things that can happen, because you can't see the tug and you don't know whether you're in position or out of position. Although,
you're being towed on
that flight. And inevitably the tow rope broke and we had to make a forced landing. Well, he damaged his back and we both went through the perspex. I damaged here and the wrist and this sort of thing. And that was the difficulty then, because I'd damaged my head, was getting through the medical people in order to get back on flying duties, which I did.
Weren't you strapped in then?
Oh, yes, yeah, but the whole front of the glider just disintegrated. Mm. We went through the perspex. And, of course, picked up by the Americans who were shouting about, hurry up, it's going to catch fire, it's going to catch fire. And I had great difficulty in convincing them that there was nothing to catch fire. Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. So we got away from that and taken to an American hospital, spent some time near Newbury, and then transferred to a British Army unit, and eventually was discharged. And of course my squadron had moved from Stony Cross up here to Keevil, so I finished up here at Keevil and was seconded to a chap named Bob Lund, L-U-N-D, who was my first pilot. The sad part about that is that I did D-Day with him, and then afterwards went off to flying school to get my first pilot's wings. And I've never heard or seen or heard of Bob Lund since. He never joined the Regimental Association. He doesn't appear on any roll of honour or anything like this anywhere at all. I did find a cutting where a chap who, after Arnhem and getting away from prison camp when the Germans had vacated it, he does relate that he was with two other men, one of which was Bob Lund, but he has no indication of his whereabouts either.
So when you went to Keevil, you continued your training there, did you?
Yes, I was second pilot. You were allocated a first pilot whose job then was to train you to a degree as much as he could. He didn't have many more hours than you did, but that's the way it worked. And then
tell me what this training consists of. You were towed off the ground, were you?
Yeah. The glider training, yes. Yeah. It was nearly all what we call circuits and bumps. In other words, you would be allocated for flying, say, on morning, 9 o'clock, you report over the airfield, on your particular flight. And there'd probably be about 10 gliders, 10 tugs. And they would take you off. They would just get you up to about 2,000 feet, do a circuit, and you would cast off, you would come round, and you would do a landing, you see. Aiming for spots all the time, you see, marked areas. So that was a concentration. And of course, the beauty of the Horsa was it had these wonderfully big flaps whereby you could put them down, you could put the nose of the aircraft down and you could point it at your spot, if you like. And although it was quite a degree and quite an angle, the airspeed would not build up because of these huge flaps. You sort of sick it on the flaps, if you like. And then, of course, you control it by reducing the flap or increasing it in order to achieve the position you wanted.
What sort of speed was your approach?
About 75 knots, 75, 80 knots. Yes, it would depend on your load, of course. Obviously, if you were heavily loaded, then you had to be a bit faster because otherwise you'd stall.
So you'd practice with different loads, would you?
You practice with different loads. You'd have different gliders with different loads so that you're not switching loads about and you just transfer from one glider to another. But mainly it was with a virtually empty glider most of your training.
What aircraft were used as tugs?
Mainly, when we were at Keble, they were all Stirlings, and although of course when we went on training to training school on gliders, then of course it became Dakotas and DC-3s, this sort of thing. There was an intermediate glider called the Hotspur, which you probably heard about, and that was towed by a single engine aircraft, either a Miles Master 3 or in some cases a Lysander. That was an aircraft about 45 foot wingspan. It carried two pilots in tandem, sat the one behind looking over the top of the other, and you could get seven or eight troops in, so it was not very big. But that again had fairly efficient flaps and so on.
Where did you train on those?
Went up to Shobden, which is near Hereford.
Uh-huh.
They had various ones around the country, but that's the one that I went to.
And you went there before you went to Keble, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
You did that. You came out of the powered elementary flying training school and then, of course, went on to glider training on the light aircraft, on the, well, medium-type aircraft, if you like, medium weight. And then, of course, you didn't look at a hawser until you'd passed through that and been seconded to a squadron. And then, of course, that started from...
You weren't your glider pilot's wings on the Hotspur, did you?
There was a change at one stage. Yes, I did get my wings after the... Hotspur training. Some didn't, and then of course later on they shortened the course because they were desperate to get people involved, and they brought up a very small wing with the letter G in the middle, which was, we regarded it as second pilot's wings, you see. But I was fortunate in having been awarded my wings having finished at glider training school, because I did a full course, you see. Those who did a shorter course got the smaller wings, which was a terrible bone of contention for a long, long time. So there we are. So, yeah, eventually we got to Keble. So then we're training with our minds on D-Day, which nobody knew the date of at that time. I got on extremely well with this chap, Bob Land. I often feel that he was probably a public schoolboy.